Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging.
I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I'm going to. Because that was perfect. That's me. I love it. It's a great challenge for you to look down every nook and cranny. I could be here forever. Just to put things in perspective. And I think that's a sign of a good detective.
This is the Narelle Fraser Conversations on Australian True Crime. Because women don't always have to be the subjects of true crime for all the worst reasons.
And I thought I was going to get pinged there and then.
The following podcast contains accounts of sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised.
You have to remove your sense of outrage and anger and fury in your judgment, and you have to be able to work with him to put his life back together.
My guest today, you know sex offenders better than most, their tricks, their manipulative ways, and how they operate. He knows how they think and how cunning they are at manipulating their victims into behaving in ways that others, like us, can find hard to fathom. He spent years rehabilitating sex offenders, young and old, and training specialist detectives, like myself, in how to understand and better interview sex offenders about their crimes. He's a criminologist, a forensic interview advisor, and a drama therapist. He's managed the sex offences and child abuse team, SOCKETS, that you know I've spoken about, at Victoria Police, and the last count there was about 43 SOCKET teams in the state. He's trained police members in understanding sex offending and developing effective interview processes. Before working with Victoria Police, he worked in the field of sex offender treatment for over 20 years. He's worked in custodial and community offender treatments with adult and adolescent offenders. He established and ran the Male Adolescent He established and ran the Male Adolescent Program for Positive Sexuality for 14 years, working to rehabilitate young people 10 to 21 years of age who sexually offend. And that program had an extraordinarily high success rate of 95%, one analysis found, in stopping recidivism among attendees. He's also worked with adult sex offenders jailed in Ararat. He's trained and presented both national and international, and he's written a book called The Whole Story, which is available in all your leading bookstores. Well, anyway, that's all we've got time for, Patrick. So thanks for coming in. Have a lovely day.
Thanks a lot, Narelle. It's lovely to be here, and thanks for that long introduction.
Patrick, first of all, I've got a bit of a plan today. If we can talk about your years as an expert in dealing with sex offenders and sex offender programs, firstly, and then I'd like to discuss, if we could, the gap that you saw in how the justice system dealt with sex offences and sex offenders. So I suppose I'd like to start off with, what was the reason that you were drawn to a career which others, understandably, find so repulsive and so disgusting?
I think, like most people who are in this type of work, I didn't do it deliberately, really. I was working in a theatre company, and I bumped into some people who were working in prisons, and they were doing theatre and drama therapy work in prisons, mostly with violent men and sex offenders, and I was really interested in what they were doing. So when they came to work in the UK, I was a part of the first company, and they're still going. They're called Geese Theatre Company, and they're still going. And yeah, I trained to be a drama therapist then when I was with Geese. And then we used to work at this clinic for men who offend against children. I mean, some of them had raped adults as well, but they were ostensibly there for offending against children. And I really enjoyed the work there with them. I found it fascinating, and they offered me a job, and that's really how it started. So I became the drama therapist for the clinic, and I ran group every day with 8 to 12 men, depending on who was there at any one time. And it was utterly fascinating. And then, so when I moved to Australia, we were just here starting to work with offenders, and in particular young offenders. And so I bumped into a woman called Felicity Dunn, who asked me with her to help set up MAPS, which is the Male Adolescent Program for Positive Sexuality. And it was the first community program for young people who have sex offending problems in Australia, about way back in 1993. And so it sort of went from there, really. And then after that, I was on a committee that Christine Nixon, the then police commissioner, set up, looking at reducing sexual assault. And from that, there was a job in the sockets, and so on and so on. So I've just sort of moved as things have come along. And I've moved further away from theatre in a way, and more towards crime and sex offenders. And we're still learning about offenders and how to deal with them and how to prosecute them and investigate them every day, almost. So it's fascinating.
Now, you said that a couple of times, Patrick, that it's fascinating. What is fascinating about it?
It's interesting to see the way they see the world and hear the way they talk. But underneath it all, I guess there's a sort of driver of, how is this happening so much? How is this so bad? I mean, when we talk later on about investigations, you'll see how few of them get to court and how few people report. You know, why is that? Once you get into this work, it's sort of impossible to let it go, Rick.
It is. And I know what you mean about fascinating, because from my point of view, investigating sexual offences and offenders, because I am fascinated, I'm interested in what makes them that way. Do you think it starts from childhood or before childhood? What the reason? Is there a reason?
The typical answer is it's different in every case. If people are listening in and want to know about the theory, well, the one we used to teach to police investigators is called implicit theory. And the idea there is these things all start somewhere in childhood. They're not directly learned necessarily. And they came up with 5 core theories that they hold that make them more likely to offend than people who don't hold these theories. The first one's dangerous world. And the idea there is that Most child molesters perceive the adult world to be a dangerous place. So they find adult connection quite difficult, which is why they say things like, I understand children and children understand me, stuff like that. And the next one is entitlement. So they have a sense of entitlement to behave in the way that they want to. And perhaps the most clear example of that I ever heard was from, he was a priest actually in a group. And he said that he had to give his life to the church and to his community, had to be available 24/7. And then he said he was entitled to have a little bit back. And that little bit back was sexually abusing his parishioners' children. The third one in the top of the list is uncontrollability. And everybody knows that because it's the one where we say it's not really my fault because of X, Y, and Z, you know. So then you get those top three, which are dangerous world, entitlement, uncontrollability. Those three things you see in almost all sort of people who are offending in some way or another. But what they were finding with child molesters were there were two others that came up time and time and time again. The first was that they saw children as sexual objects and they were able to justify that to themselves. And I suspect a lot of listeners to this podcast will think, well, that's utterly shocking and terrible and completely against our community values. But if you went online and looked at pornography, the biggest single category of porn will be teen porn. Yeah. It's more than $100 billion a year industry now. And then there's an awful lot of child abuse imagery as well. So that's probably worth $10 billion a year as an industry. So there's an extraordinary amount of material available there that says perhaps, you know, it's really not that bad. And of course, no surprise that sex offenders use that as a way of saying, well, lots of other people are doing it and it can't be that bad and da, da, da. And then the last one on the list they found, and I think this is perhaps the most damaging of all, is that they wrote up as nature of harm. And what that is, and if you spend any time with sex offenders, you will hear this. They find ways to minimize the damage that they have done, to say that, well, she was too young to remember, or I was just showing her love, or it was a special relationship. They find ways to say, what I'm doing really isn't that bad. So the answer to your question is, yes, it all comes from somewhere, but it gets built up over time. So people begin to see the world and justify their behavior in particular ways. Now, some people will hold those theories and not act on them. But if you hold those theories, you're more likely to act on them than someone who doesn't think the world works that way.
Do you think that a sex offender is born a sex offender?
No. Okay. Is the short answer to that question. No, I don't. And I think in some ways it's a useful notion. Look, some people are obviously born with damage in their DNA and trouble in their lives. But my experience whilst I was at MAPS, we probably saw 600 or so boys. I must have worked with thousands of offenders and suspects when in policing. Almost always you can see where the damage gets done along the way. And you can see the things in their lives that have gone wrong. You can see the way that they've made poor choices and, you know, believing the world owes them something or whatever it is that's driving it.
Yeah.
And the other really interesting thing for your listeners is I think a lot of people believe that not only does sex offending start in childhood, but it continues throughout their lives. And what we found is that, and we made that mistake actually here in Australia early on when we started working with adolescents, we were far too sure that what we were doing was stopping a lifetime of offending. And that is true for some of them, but it's not true for most of them. People thought that sex offenders were completely different to every kind of offender 20 years or so ago. And what we found over the decades is they aren't really. They're remarkably similar. So young people who are sex offending in their teenage years, whilst they can do an enormous amount of damage and they can be quite prolific offenders, the majority will stop as they get into adult life, just as other types of offenders will. And there's lots of research evidence of that, suggests really only about 20% of them will turn up in the adult system for sex offenders. And about 40 or 50% will turn up for other kinds of offending, but not as many as we used to think will keep going with sex offending in their lives.
So why do they stop?
Well, they stop for the reason that everybody else stops. They find adult life. They get cars and jobs and relationships, and they find intimacy and reasons to not do it and develop belief systems about, you know, love and compassion and connection and things that start that. The research is much clearer now about all the different ages that people start. And so some start around the age of puberty. There's a big group that starts then, and they mostly target children in their family, extended family, and local neighbourhood. And then there's another group that starts in late adolescence, and they tend to target peer age, mostly girls, but sometimes boys. And then really, and this was a big surprise in the literature when it turned up, the biggest group, it appears, starts in middle age. And now that there's online offending more commonly, it's an even bigger group because they start in middle age. And finally, there's a sort of fourth group that was a deep shock as well as a surprise, which is the number of people who, men, post-working life, who begin offending at that time. And so those tend to target, you know, their grandchildren and nieces and nephews and so on. So there's really, what we're finding is it's much more complicated picture than you start as a sex offender and that's the way your life goes. Some of them desist, most of them desist, and others start at different times. So we've got to be aware of all these different problems that come to pass and what it is, where the risks are with people who start and why they start.
Do you think that when you're just talking there about middle age and after people stop work, does it start off as a fascination and then grow into something more? Is that?
I think sometimes it's that. I think what you'll find, back to your question earlier on, is you'll find fault lines in people's backgrounds and childhoods. You'll find things they lack, missed. You'll find that, you know, they didn't learn how to communicate their wants and needs. They didn't learn how to have a proper argument, you know, how to manage their emotions. They didn't learn how to manage their wants and desires and put limits on those. So you see some people where they'll get into pornography, for example, and then, look, pornographers are incredibly good at offering you the next exciting thing along the line. So you might start with something that's within the bounds of, but then they'll say, well, have you thought about this? And have you thought, click on this? And have you thought about that? So there are clearly people now who enter that world in order to find one particular kind of image, and in no time at all sometimes are somewhere much, much more dangerous, and finding that they have an attraction and an interest in that they didn't necessarily know they had. And for others, they have that attraction already. And particularly now that the internet has made that available, you can pretty much see whatever you want, whenever you want it.
You talk a lot about males. You ever had a group of, or is there enough sex offenders to form a group? Or
I mean, there are in some places, so we certainly haven't had that here. This is, to use the language, this is a very gendered crime, predominantly men and boys abusing women, girls, and sometimes boys. And if you look at the figures, let's say you took who was on the sex offender register for and they're mostly child molesters on the register, as I'm sure you know, most of your listeners probably do. But so if you looked at who was on the register right now, there'd probably be about 5,000 men and maybe 100 women. Somewhere between a third and a half of them would have offended with a male, either complicit with or coerced by a male. Then the next biggest group are probably those who are trafficking children for sex work. And then you get a relatively small group at the top of that 100 who are offending in their own right. So you get that kind of teacher lover type. So typically she's in her 20s, early 30s, and he's about 13 or 14. Although the last job I had at Big Pole, she was 51 and he was 11. And they can target, just like males who target other people's children, and they can look quite similar. But the drivers of offending in women are really different in some ways than they are for men. And so they might have Dangerous World, for example, but they're much more likely to have experienced dangerous world from family violence or from abuse themselves. So their reasons for offending are much more complex than they are for men.
In my career with sex offenders, I had two women, and one was a young woman of about 24 who a group of young school kids she met. Well, I was a brother of one of her friends or something, and so they used to come around to her place of a night, and she'd ply them with pornography and alcohol. And I shouldn't say this, but I thought it was interesting that it was the parents that were complaining, not the young boys. Yeah. But she eventually went inside for that, and because I felt very strongly, I thought if that was a man that was doing that to young females, how would I treat him? And I didn't want to treat her any differently, and I didn't. She had a young child, and I thought, well, that's your responsibility, not mine. And the other one was a woman a bit like that one you just said, where she was early 50s, and again, it was schoolboys, and she was giving them a bit of a kickstart before school. So, there's only two in all my career.
Well, just to deal with the thing you said before about children, it's pretty common for children to be loyal to the perpetrator, male or female, to be loyal to them, to keep going around to their houses, to keep the secrets. Yeah. All of that's in the grooming. It's all about the way they form relationships with children. So that's pretty common. The second thing is, the literature is very clear that the damage psychologically to boys can be just as devastating as it is to girls. And it's just as damaging. And I agree with you, she should face the consequences of her behavior just as a male offender should. Absolutely right. Some of the fact that there are so small numbers is because we're not looking. And there is clear evidence in the behavior of teenage girls when they're surveyed about their behavior that coercive behavior in younger years is much more common in girls and young women than previously thought. Now, it's still far and away dominated, but males have sort of four times more likely to be coercive and abusive, at least. Yeah. We are just beginning to realise that more young women need support and intervention with their behaviour than we had previously thought.
The porn industry, but you know, on the internet, it's got a lot to answer for, hasn't it? I think it's sent sex offending out of control, or is that just my perception?
I don't think anyone's saying that pornography causes sex offending in and of itself. One of the, and your listeners can look this up, he's been around in the field forever, a chap called Malamuth, has written a lot of good research material about who is affected by pornography. And his latest view that I read suggests that about 40% of us have our attitudes and our beliefs shaped by the pornography that we watch. And about 7% of the total have problematic behaviours that are connected with what it is that they're watching. And I think I've no doubt, really, if you asked anyone who was a forensic medical examiner at the moment, for example, say to them what's changed in the examinations you've done over the last 10 years or so, let's say in the last five, probably choking and choke injuries are much more prevalent as they have become pornography. And in the decade before that, it would have been anal injuries, which again became hugely prominent in pornography, even though, you know, still the majority of the community doesn't practice that. So there's no doubt there are connections between the values and attitudes in pornography and the behaviours depicted in pornography, and they have an effect on people. And for some people, particularly men who have quite strong traditional gender roles and who have firm beliefs in impersonal sex and their rights to that sort of behaviour, they can have pornography can have quite a significant effect on them.
Could you explain a bit to us about how do you treat a sex offender and some of the processes that you've used?
Going back to the discussion we were having earlier about if people's lives are off track, generally you can find a variety of different gaps, damages, fault lines that have occurred over their growing up. And so you'll need to address that. Do you remember in the training, there's a film that we show and it's about the guy who's grooming his daughter and how he feels about that? Do you remember that film?
Oh, yes.
So it was an exercise you used to do in the clinic, getting men to act out their grooming and their manipulations up to, but not including the offence itself. And so in the one that we filmed, he used other men in the group to be different characters and he goes through all the grooming processes and they've rehearsed it and they've worked on it. And there's that element we put in the exercise where he has to turn to camera every now and then and say, this is what I'm thinking now, this is what I'm doing now, or this is why I'm doing this. And the reason that we did that is because most guys say at the beginning of treatment, you say, well, how did your offending start? They say something along the lines of, well, I don't know, it just happened. And so some of the early exercises, you have to get past that it just happened idea. And that drama therapy exercise, a very effective one. Getting him to see that he was thinking his way through this, that he was the one that was driving this. And I remember when we first did the exercise, at the end of it, he got to the point where he was about to do the offending and the scene finished and we all sat down and he's in front of the group and his colleagues who are playing different characters in the story where everybody sat down to a long silence. And then he said to himself, she didn't have any choice at all, did she? And there was another long silence as we let that thought sink in, you know, that actually this had been all him and all the stuff he'd said to himself about how special it was and how she loved him and all that. They were soulmates, was all crap, and it was all him. And there was a long silence. And then he put his hand in a fist and punched himself in the side of the face really hard, loud enough that it made a real smack. And I got a jog because I was sat right next to him. But I thought about that a lot since. I think what he was trying to do in that moment was kind of drive that thought out of his head.
I always found it really interesting interviewing sex offenders. I'm not saying empathise with them, but just to not act shocked. I wanted them to sort of think that I sort of understood. I don't quite know how to describe it, but if I didn't look shocked and I was interested, I don't know why, I was interested in why they chose that time, that person. If you talk to them and listen, I found a lot of them wanted to tell me.
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things to explain to coppers who are deciding whether they want to work in specialist sexual crime investigation is, one, can you be non-judgmental in the way that you go about it? And two, can you believe that he actually wants to explain himself? You don't have to beat it out of him. You don't have to coerce it. If you sit back and listen and ask the right questions and show curiosity without judgment, he'll probably tell you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you to the following patrons: Alison, Ginny Hall, Jodie Deeth, Laura Bray, Amy O, and Mark Offmalovia. Emily and I are currently producing a regular video series for our patrons in which we recommend true crime documentaries, books, podcasts, and whatever else we can think of that is entertaining in isolation. My pick for this week, by the way, is the brand new podcast that we foreshadowed some months ago. It's called Who Killed Leanne Holland? We'll have an interview with the producer of that podcast for our patrons in coming weeks. He's also the man behind Beenham Valley Road. You've heard from him before, Jamie Pultz. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/osttruecrimepod.
I'm of the belief that most serious sex offenders can't be rehabilitated. But I'm not sure you'd agree with me.
I don't agree with you, and I don't. And look, partly from the conversation that we had earlier, that you know, the evidence suggests that's not true. That they will desist. At least a significant group will desist. The difficulty is, how do you tell the difference between the ones that will and the ones that won't? That is a difficult judgment to make, and it's one of the things I'm glad, in a way, I'm not in treatment anymore, because those kinds of decisions that you make can really weigh quite heavily on you.
Do you think, if we looked at, for instance, Sean Price, who raped and murdered Marcia Vukotic, James Todd, who raped and murdered Iridis Dixon, Cody Herman, who raped and murdered Aya Massawi, Adrian Bailey with Jill Maher, and, of course, Peter Dupas. With those men, they are really serious sex offenders. Are you saying that you believe their upbringing, this is a bit harsh, but their upbringing is the cause of their behaviour?
No, I'm not saying that. And look, isn't it? Firstly, it's interesting that we remember their names, don't we? And we remember their names because they're unusual. What it tells you is the vast majority of people doing this, given that there are so many of them, are ordinary and we don't remember their names. And these men are incredibly important. We should know everything we can about them. We should know how they got to be the way they were. We should know what they did and why they did it. And I'm not saying that their background is to blame. I'm saying what you find there are the reasons how they ended up the way they are will be in their backgrounds. Yeah, absolutely.
How do you explain somebody like, say, Peter Dupas? He had a signature where he would cut their breasts off, the women's breasts off.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
I don't know. Look, in all of it, you'll find my old boss back in the UK in the clinic I first worked at, he said the simple rule of thumb, if you want to work out where this behavior is coming from, anger, fear, power, control, and sex. And in each of these stories, you'll find a combination of those five things in different measure.
In your treatment programs, would you say that most sex offenders admit their offences?
No, they probably don't. Or at least they will hold back elements of what they did and how they did it. They'll be ashamed of certain aspects. They'll be afraid of the consequences of future disclosure. But most will admit in principle that they were responsible for the offending, and most will admit, they'll certainly admit what you already know about.
Is there a particular sex offender that you worked with that you believed was so deranged and dangerous that you couldn't treat or deal with him?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Yeah. Yeah. And some of those probably were very early on working in prisons and in, you know, closed forensic psychiatric units. There were some very, very scary men there. And even though now if you don't do treatment, you don't get parole, so they all get moved into the treatment program. You know, you can get through treatment without change. Of course you can. They're not as invisible in their lack of interest as they think they are. You know, so some of them think they can say all the right things and everybody's fooled, but you can certainly get through treatment without it really having impacted on you in any way, shape or form. Yeah.
So has there ever been a sex offender that unsettled you for some reason, not feeling frightened of their rage or whatever, but just somebody that really did your head in?
One of the most unsettling ones of those was somebody who said he knew where my children went to school. That those kinds of things I found unsettling, you know. But actually, more often, it's reading victim statements and meeting victims or complainants, you know, in policing and the things that they tell you. I found those the most emotionally upsetting. And often it really wasn't necessarily the offending itself that was most distressing. It was the cruelty of the manipulations and the grooming and the way they controlled people and how they made them believe that what was going on was okay, or how they threatened them. It was those little things. And, you know, I'm sure like you, I've got, you know, way too many in my head that I wish weren't there. And one of the skills you got to learn in the job is how to manage the emotional upset you will inevitably feel.
That's interesting you say that about the statements, because that I believe that was my forte, taking the statements from the victim and getting right into how they felt, how it affected them. And it's interesting that you say that it was reading those statements, because I took those statements. I was just so interested, in a way, in what happened, when, why, how you felt, to the point where I was almost there with them. And maybe it was just the huge amount of statements that I took that ended up, doing me in.
It could be. I mean, I certainly felt I'd reached my time limit, and, you know, moving around and being in different parts and trying to do different things. You definitely know when it's time to move.
I'd like to move on to the justice system and how we deal with, or we have dealt in the past, and how we do now with sex offenders and sex offences. So you saw a problem, didn't you, when you looked into this?
Yes. The background for your listeners about the sex offence and child abuse teams is that back in 2004, the Law Reform Commission looked at the way the whole system dealt with sex offending, and it gave everybody a serve, including policing. And it said the problem in policing is that there are cultures of disbelief where police believe that false reporting figures are much, much higher than they are, that there's no specialism, and that victims have lost faith in the process. So that was the gist. And so from that, they brought a couple of us, myself and a chap called Mark Barnett, in to change the training program and create a specialist training program for investigators who were investigating sexual crimes of all kinds against adults or children. And the biggest issue that we saw is that having worked with offenders, in a way, once they're in treatment, they tell you all sorts of things. And so there's a huge amount of knowledge about how they manipulate people, how long they're in relationship with people before they start offending, how they keep secrets within a family or an organization or an institution like the church or scouts or whatever. And what we realized is the whole system was set up to investigate the events of what took place. So like, because the courts want to know for the charge, what went where, how far did it go in, what can we charge them with? And generally the next question is, how can anyone back up what you're saying? Well, almost all offending happens in secret, in isolation. Nearly all of it happens in the home of the perpetrator or the home of the victim or premises known to both parties where there is no one else present. So really it was very difficult for our investigators to see where the success rates would come from. So what we said is, most important of all, this isn't a crime of events. This is a crime of relationship. This is a crime where 85% of people are offended by people they know. And of the 15% of people who are offended out in public space, the majority of those are acquaintances as well. So the stranger rapes and the stranger assaults, well, unfortunately, they are common, they're nowhere near as common as the relationship-based offending. So the vast majority of sex crime that was being investigated was being investigated completely wrong. There were no witnesses. There was no DNA. There was no bruise. There was no CCTV. And so police got frustrated very quickly. Plus which, you know, victims were complicated in the way they told their stories, and they didn't really understand the stories that they were listening to. So, you know, failure rates and complaint withdrawal rates were really very high. So what we did in the end was create a new way of thinking about understanding sex offending. First moment that the suspect and the complainant are together, or the offender and the victim, and to look at the entirety of that relationship and see where the evidence is of what took place later on. So think about a line, a continuum, and you think about the moment that he first thinks about, I want to do this thing to this person, and then think about how long until she comes into the police station or the socket and says, this is what's happened to me. Somewhere along that line, he will begin the offending itself, but there's often quite a significant amount of space, hours, days, weeks, sometimes even years, before he commits the first offense that he can be prosecuted for. And our argument was, if you understand sex offending, you realize that all the answers to what took place and all the things that will persuade a magistrate or a jury of what took place between those people is in the nature of that relationship, how he manipulated her. And so we changed some language around. So all our investigators knew what grooming was, for example, but they didn't really understand how it worked. And that they didn't really understand that most grooming is non-sexual. So they got the sexual bit, like showed porn, said, have you ever had a boyfriend, you know, all that. But they didn't understand how he isolated them from their family members or their siblings, or how he persuaded them to keep secrets, or to see themselves as the initiator of the act, or all the tricks that he pulled to make them, to draw them in and make them a part of a relationship before the offense took place, is actually what we'll explain to a jury later on of what happened between these people. And so the sort of flip side of that is, we're all working in a system that's set up for other human beings to try and understand a story. That's really what this is all about. People who sit on a jury or a magistrate, what they're listening to is a story. And what we said is, you haven't got the story. You've only got 10% of it. So how will they understand why she continued in a relationship? How will they understand why she never had any injuries? How will they understand why he kept going around to the guy's house? All these things, they can't be explained unless you understand the nature of a relationship that he created between the two of them from the beginning. And so that's the way we moved the investigative framework, and we called it Whole Story, and we started training to it, and we started evaluating and researching whether it was having an impact on investigators. And the most important thing that we found down the track is that it reduces the amount of responsibility they give to victims significantly. And most importantly of all, and we're about to publish on this incidentally in a journal called Criminal Justice and Behavior, I think we're the only police force anywhere in the world that has shown that training change sustained over a 12-month period. It's a really important finding. And what it shows is if you teach people how sexually abusive relationships are created by offenders. They are much better at investigating them. They're much better at listening to victims. They're much less judgmental. Then they gain better evidence.
The trouble with that from a police point of view, though, is that years ago you'd spend a couple of hours taking a statement from a victim. The investigations didn't take, you know, a great deal of time. But now with that whole story, hey, I am the biggest fan of whole story, but it takes a lot longer. It takes a lot of patience. And I've had statements where it's taken days to get that from the, you know, the very first connection or interaction to the very last. And you need a lot of patience to do that.
Yes, you do. So I think the longest one I had was from down in Gippsland somewhere. He, the detective in the case, had to do 11 sessions. She was describing 40 years of abuse. 11 sessions of 2 to 3 hours each, an extraordinary amount of work. And look, what it says is, like, the central skill set in any specialist investigation is listening and communicating and interviewing. That's really what it's different from most other policing in that it's time consuming. It's much more time consuming, and it's concentrated around stories and relationship building with complainants so that you can interview them. And look, our argument with whole story is it's time well spent, because if you do the old school, what went where and blah, 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 you know, the avenues of inquiry you end up with after that are very few and far between. But if you've got all of the grooming, it's amazing how many other people have seen and heard the grooming that was non-sexual. And in the training, we call it grooming one and grooming two, right? So grooming one is the non-sexual stuff, all the early manipulations and the construction of the relationship. And grooming two is the more sexual stuff. It's amazing how much of grooming one you can interview other witnesses about, who've seen it and heard it. And so you get better avenues of inquiry, you get clearer evidence. And often in the suspect interview, you can put a lot of that grooming one to him and he'll admit it without necessarily knowing that he's digging himself a bit of a hole. And then, of course, more often when you get to grooming two and the offending, he shuts down and says, I don't know what you're talking about. But by then he can have done himself quite a lot of damage. Our argument was, yes, the interviews take longer. Yes, you need the right kind of people doing this sort of work, but it's time well spent. It's time well spent on their training, and it's time well spent in the interview.
Yeah, I think getting the whole story, it just sets so much more of a scene, rather than, as you said, it used to be, where did it go, how long, and what happened then?
So our prosecutors say, because we trained the police prosecutors as well, which I really enjoyed. It was they said the most useful thing about whole story for them was to help them create what they called their case concept. And so whenever they're looking at the narratives and all the evidence that's in front of them, they're trying to create the story and the concept of the story they're listening to so that they can explain it to the listener, who's usually the magistrate or, you know, if they use it in the upper courts, the jury. And before really something like whole story, if you don't have a concept like that, it's much harder to persuade people of what's taken place. It's very hard to explain things like that. Injury, another one that we talked about briefly before. Why are there no injuries? Because there was submission. If you want to persuade people of what took place, and I think in courts now, certainly with matters against children, we've come a long way persuading the general public that there is an awful lot of abuse of children going on in our communities. And I'm not sure we've come so far in sexual assault and rape of adults. I think we've still got a long way to go. And there are a lot of myths and misconceptions, you know, continued relationship, lack of injury, memory issues, false reporting. So, for example, most people still think false reporting rate is relatively high. Well, it's probably somewhere around 5%. Most people think that you would go and tell someone immediately, you go and tell someone in authority. Well, actually, only about 5% of people do that. So I could go on and on and on and on and on. And I think we've got a long way to go to have these stories better heard by policing, but also better heard by juries and the general public. We've got a long way to go.
I suppose one of those myths is, why didn't she punch him? Why didn't she scream? Why didn't she kick?
So the thing that we talk about in training is that fight, flight, freeze, surrender. And we put those four words up on, and we ask investigators to say, you know, take aside political correctness. What is it you'd like people to do when they're being sexually offended against in some way? And of course, almost everybody picks either fight or flight as the thing they want people to do. Then the next one, they can sort of understand that sometimes people freeze. And that's reasonably common, but far and away the most common is surrender. And the reason is more often than not, they're already in a relationship and this has been going on for a while.
Yep.
And the abuse has been going on for a while, even if the sexual element of the abuse is only just starting. Where people are taken, you know, by surprise, sometimes people will fight back or run away. But generally, it's only when the surprise is sufficient so that their brain doesn't have a time to think. When we've got time to think, we tend to do nothing. And there's a great quote, trauma shocks the brain, freezes the mind, and stuns the body. Shocks the brain, freezes the mind, and stuns the body.
Oh, yeah.
And when you think about that, in those circumstances, what do we expect people to do? If their brain, if their body is stunned and their brain is frozen, people do the most extraordinary things. And more often than not, what they do is nothing. They submit to what's taking place because they want to survive the experience.
And I suppose, you know, in most movies, most people, most victims in a movie I've seen will fight. They'll scream, they'll kick, they'll scratch them.
Yeah.
You know, they'll get DNA under their fingernails and it's all very easy. But the victims that I've dealt with, it's very rarely like that, very rare.
Yes. You got to stop watching those crime shows, Narelle. They're not good for you.
I don't watch them, Patrick, because I don't have a TV. You know, I look back and I think to myself that's possibly why I lasted as long as I did. Because and I feel it was a sanctuary in a way to come home and just get away from all the grief and trauma and crime and violence. It was lovely to come home and not have to watch it again on the TV because you can't escape it. I suppose in a nutshell with your teachings concerning the whole story concept, it's really about getting the focus off what the victim did and or didn't do and onto how the suspect got or the offender got him or her to do what they did or didn't do. Would you agree with that?
I would, yeah. So my colleague Tony used to say, we've got to move away from all the questions of why did she do that. I mean, you've probably got to ask him anyway, but you can't just ask why. You've got to move on to the question of how did he get her to do that? And you've got to ask both. Why would she do that and how did he get her to do that? And if you can understand both the answers to both those questions, you've probably got most of the whole story.
So, and another thing too with whole story, I find most times that a victim of, let's say, a sex offence, they will, and generally it's a she that I've dealt with. There are quite a few male victims, but the majority of ones I dealt with were female. But I'd have to say that listening to the whole story and taking down the whole story, the victim would obviously think, actually, she's not trying to get rid of me. She's not in a hurry. She wants to hear. Like, she's got to feel better, doesn't she, if you're taking the time and listening to the whole thing.
Absolutely. And we did some research on what we thought our investigators considered the most important skills and qualities that a specialist sexual crime investigator ought to have. And we tested them before training, after training, and 12 months after 12 months in the field. And at the end of that one, which was the most interesting, they said the top five in order were empathy, good communication skills, patience, good investigative skills, and open-mindedness. That's not typical in policing, is it? Though that as the top five in a skill set. It has to be typical when you're dealing with family violence, when you're dealing with child sexual abuse, when you're dealing with rape and sexual assault, that these need to be the core skills we're training people to be good at.
But, you know, years ago, when I first started, when was it, 87 I first started, it was really drilled out of me, empathy. Sympathy, because it wasn't looked upon as a skill. A policing skill was about getting a confession. That's all it was. If you got a confession, you know, you'd be patted on the back. It didn't matter how you got that confession. And I have to say, a lot of confessions that I was involved, that I witnessed, were really belting the crook. That is not a confession. It's a skill, isn't it, to have empathy? And you can learn to have empathy. Today's been an amazing insight into understanding just a little bit about sex offending and our treatment of victims of sexual assault. Thank you so much for your insight, Patrick. And out there, please don't forget Dr. Patrick Tidmarsh's book, The Whole Story. Go and grab yourself a copy.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime, made in association with the Acast Creator Network. We'll be back next week. Take care.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Australian True Crime, the live show, is coming.